Welcome to Straight Thinking, the GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, get your popcorn. We're going to the movies again. Ken, what are we going to see, or at least talk about, and why?
Well, I like the movies, and I definitely like popcorn with lots of butter. But of course, I'll bet all of our listeners know that there has been a C.S. Lewis movie released just before the start of the holidays. I've seen it a couple times. Joe, I know you've seen it. And C.S. Lewis, of course, is one of my favorite Christian thinkers, Christian writers, Christian apologists. So I want to talk a little bit about the movie in this program, and then we'll do another program where we'll talk about some of C.S. Lewis's arguments for the truth of the Christian faith. So off to the movies.
All right, sounds good. As you mentioned, I saw it, Ken, and I know you have, and I know you're going to give your impressions of it, but I got to say, I was taken by the actor, Max McLean. I found myself saying afterwards, like, I could listen to him all day.
He is a charming man. I don't know if you have seen his stage play by the same title, but that's been remarkably popular. I saw it at the University of California at Irvine a few years ago. And so he's quite a dynamic presenter of Clive Staples Lewis, if you will. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought we would talk a little bit before getting into some of the details of the movie. When I read Alistair McGrath's very fine biography of C.S. Lewis, A Life, McGrath at the end of his book talks about what he calls the Lewis phenomenon. And I think that that's exactly right. It's ironic that just before Lewis's death, he was talking with his secretary. This was Walter Hooper. And I thank God for Walter Hooper. Quite frankly, a lot of people probably wouldn't know as much about Lewis, or Lewis would not have the kind of impact had it not been for this American man who came in 1963. And Lewis kind of got him involved as his secretary. And then, of course, with Lewis's death, Walter Hooper was very persuasive with publishers to get the books that had gone out of print by Lewis back into print. And, you know, he really dedicated his life to Lewis's writings. And up until Hooper's death not too long ago, he was part of the C.S. Lewis estate. So interestingly enough, before Lewis's death, and again, he died a week before a week before his 65th birthday, so he was 64, he said that he thought 5 years after he was dead, nobody would remember him anymore. And I think that that's quite ironic, because I think that Lewis was a very prescient and almost a prophetic type thinker. For example, I think Lewis clearly saw the future in terms of the kind of cultural challenges. I think Lewis understood things like postmodernism, relativism when it comes to truth and morality. And I think his books are quite, they're very skilled at kind of handling that type of topic. Now, what about this Lewis phenomenon that McGrath mentions? Well, I think it continues. For example, His books today sell really well. All you have to do is talk about the Chronicles of Narnia. These are that set of seven children's novels that sold more than 100 million copies. That's just a mind-boggling number. The Wikipedia says that they are in print in 47 different languages, and so a lot of people, amazingly, Joe and Dave, they know about Lewis, but their experience with him is almost exclusively through his children's novels. Mm-hmm. And I've met people, in fact, I've known people here at Reasons to Believe, and what they know of Lewis is not his apologetic writings, or even probably less known, his scholarly writings in the area of English literature. So there's many angles to C.S. Lewis. Now, a little bit more, these children's novels have been adapted for radio, television, the stage, film, and even computer games. I thought that was pretty amazing. Then, of course, his book that I like the most is Mere Christianity. I remember reading a book about Mere Christianity, and it said that since 2000, more than 3 million copies of that book had sold. Well, that book has had a real influence. It certainly influenced me, but it influenced other people. Francis Collins, for example, the famous scientist, said that C.S. Lewis had a big influence on his embracing of Christianity. Chuck Colson, the attorney for Richard Nixon during the Watergate issues. Of course, out of that context, Colson was arrested and went to prison. It was reading Mere Christianity that influenced him. Well, Christianity Today voted that Mere Christianity was the most important book of the 20th century. And that's saying a lot. I mean, you're talking about people like Karl Barth. You're talking about Pope John Paul II. I mean, there are some very influential Christian authors and writers of the 20th century. And then on the 50th anniversary of Lewis's death in 2013, there was a, he was honored and commemorated by a stone that was placed in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey. I don't know how many of you have visited Westminster Abbey. It is a mind-boggling place. It is the place where so many of the great intellectual leaders of Great Britain, of the United Kingdom, of England are buried. And in Poets' Corner, with people like Chaucer and others, they recognize C.S. Lewis as one of the great writers. Now, Lewis, of course, was Irish, but he is in there among all these great scholars in terms of English literature. So this is a C.S. Lewis phenomenon. And of course, I'm interested in this question. How is it possible that a person who has now been dead for 58 years, almost 58 years he's been dead, why has he retained the kind of popularity? And I think there are probably many reasons for that. I'm going to talk about some of those reasons in our next program, where we look at Lewis as an apologist. But this is really amazing that a Christian author carries that kind of influence. Mm. Now, let's talk a little bit about the movie. Of course, it is called a C.S. Lewis biopic. Very similar to a biopic that was done in terms of J.R.R. Tolkien in 2019, kind of talking about his early life and things like this. The title of the movie is The Most Reluctant Convert, The Untold Story of C.S. Lewis. And of course, the reluctant convert comes from Lewis's own description of his conversion, that he kind of says, I came to accept belief in God, and then later belief in Christianity, kind of kicking and screaming. I was kind of resisting these particular ideas. So that reluctant convert is definitely Lewis's idea. Now, the director of the program is a man named Norman Stone, and he directed the 1985 television movie Shadowlands. This is not the motion picture. This is not the big screen picture Shadowlands with Anthony Hopkins and Deborah Winger. That came in 1993. But this television program was very very popular. And by the way, I might say that of the C.S. Lewis scholars I've spoken with, they all kind of conclude that the Shadowlands movie was a great film, but that it was not terribly historical. Now, I'm speaking mostly here of the motion picture with Anthony Hopkins, but so Norman Stone is associated with C.S. Lewis. And of course, the central mover and shaker of this new movie is a man named Max McLean. He has done many stage presentations about Lewis. I saw him on stage a few years ago, and you know, he takes on the personality of C.S. Lewis, and he has committed a lot of what Lewis wrote in his biography to memory. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people really enjoy him. He is he's very skilled. I mean, actors, sometimes you don't give enough, I think, appreciation for how much a dedicated actor has to memorize and remember, and then to act these things out, not just remembering lines, but to do so with, you know, with a real sense of reality. Well, McLean plays Lewis in the movie. He plays the middle-aged C.S. Lewis, who is really kind of the narrator of the film, and I think it's very interesting the events that they cover. They cover Lewis's early life. They cover him as a young man. Then of course Max McLean is the narrator of the older Lewis, kind of looking back on all of these things. But all of this comes out of Surprised by Joy, which was Lewis's own autobiography, and I think I enjoyed Max McLean kind of reflecting on the life of Lewis as the thing that really struck me about the film. That was something that I really enjoyed. Joe, I wonder what your thoughts are as we kind of talk about this film.
Yeah, I appreciate your comments, and I'm resonating along with you there. One of the things that I appreciated about the actor, Max McLean, and the way the film was done, I guess that's the director, Norman Stone, is that you see him walking constantly, and he's walking in and out of halls at Oxford University and into, what's the name of his home again?
Kilns,
yeah. In and out of there and down these beautiful tree-lined walkways. All of that just adds to the grandeur, the beauty, the elegance of it. And, you know, everything is kind of said in a Louisian manner. You know, it's not, you're not at the local, whatever it is, you know, talking to your friend over the water cooler. Not that you can't have lofty conversations, but it's like, wow, the whole thing's kind of like poetic and dramatic with a guy just kind of walking around England. So I like that part of it.
it really is true. I think another very captivating element is that it's all filmed in and shot around Oxford University. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're talking about a university that goes back to the Middle Ages. I think it's almost 1,000 years old. I mean, that to me is an amazing thing. The idea that the Middle Ages were dark ages, I think is a very suspicious description given all that was produced during that era. But like you, Joe, I felt the same way. I've been to these sites. Dave, you and I took a trip with the RTB group a couple years ago and visited many of these sites. And they're really fun. I mean, they show Magdalen College, I think they call it Magdalen College, at Oxford University. They showed the kilns where Lewis lived from 1930 to 1963, to the time of his death. There is a time where Max McLean is Lewis drinking a pint there, drinking some beer in the pub, the Eagle and Child. which of course is the place where the Inklings would meet and drink and talk and talk about the various things that they had been writing. I remember walking into the Eagle and the Child and seeing the C.S. Lewis and Tolkien room, and it was It was fun just to be there, you know, and to see these kind of things. But they also showed the church where Lewis attended, not too far from his home in the Kilns, is a Anglican church, Holy Trinity Church. And I've been in that church. Dave was in that church. And there was a couple things that I thought were really interesting. The Anglican priest, if you remember that part of the film, Joe, It was played by Michael Ward. And Michael Ward has been called by N.T. Wright, quote, the foremost living Lewis scholar, unquote. So when we were in Oxford and at the church, Ward gave a talk on C.S. Lewis. And of course, he's known. Ward is well known for Planet Narnia, the idea that the Chronicles of Narnia were not done, you know, fast and loose and sloppy, but there is a real arrangement according to the medieval planets. And so Ward is a really influential individual. So it was interesting to see him play Lewis's Anglican priest. Dave, what are some of your thoughts about visiting?
Just to comment about what Joe was mentioning a little earlier about Lewis and his walking tours. That's a thing that, you know, in all the descriptions of Lewis, the biographies, is very strong. He's a real walker. He just enjoys going on these tours, walking across England. And in one book in particular, that communicates just the sense of what it's like is his space trilogy, where in the first, especially in the first volume, where he the whole thing begins on a walk that he's on, going across the country and looking for a place to stay and ending up, you know, getting caught up in this spaceship thing. Whenever I read that, I just get kind of nostalgic, a sense, what it's like to go on these walks with Lewis and what it must have been like for he and his friends to be able to engage in these and have conversations.
Yeah, I mean, it's for our listeners, if you've never been to Oxford and you get an opportunity, I would really encourage you to go. It has all these spires, and of course, Oxford is way out into the country. I would imagine it's probably a 90-minute drive from London. So you get to see a lot of the countryside of England there. And Oxford is really an incredible place, one of the very first universities in the history of Western civilization. And even today, often considered either the best or one of the very best universities. I wanted to say a little bit, of course, in the old days, people were buried in the churchyard. I've seen that in many churches where, back east, for example, and various other places in Europe, where people are buried in the churchyard, and C.S. Lewis is buried there at Holy Trinity Anglican Church. Not only is he buried there, but his brother Warney Lewis is buried there, as well as Mrs. Moore, who was the mother of one of C.S. Lewis's friends who was killed in World War II. So it's, Joe, it's really interesting. In fact, when I saw the headstone of C.S. Lewis, it is, it's not elaborate. I mean, it's not fancy. It's very, very plain there in the churchyard. There were a lot of weeds grown up around it, but you could only feel like you were at a very special place. And I remember walking into Holy Trinity Anglican Church, which I think is a great name for a church, Holy Trinity. I remember it smelled kind of musty, but you felt like this is really a great place. And I remember there was some stained glass that had both C.S. Lewis and Joy Davidman imaged there. And so that was a pretty cool part. So seeing all of these kind of things, and then having Lewis, you know, as you say, Joe, walking around kind of commenting about various places. I also think that the actors who played Lewis, they had three different actors. One when Lewis was a boy. So Lewis at 9 years old lost his mother, Flora. And that was a big event in the life of C.S. Lewis. He later said that nothing ever seemed permanent again. Everything seemed to be impermanent and changeable. So there's a young actor who plays Lewis, and I like it. Him and Warnie are running upstairs, and his dad, Albert Lewis, who was a solicitor, which is British for attorney, he comes out of his office kind of yelling at, you know, the boys. And then Flora says to her husband, you know, they're just boys. That's what boys do. They make a lot of noise. And then there was a young man that played Lewis as a young adult. And this, of course, is when he goes to the boarding school with William Kirkpatrick. They call him the Great Knock. This was one of the great mentors that C.S. Lewis had. And by the way, that actor looks a lot like Lewis. I have an image of Lewis when he joined the Somerset Light Infantry when he was 19 years old. And that actor looks a lot like the young C.S. Lewis was quite a handsome guy.
Right. He's the same actor, by the way, who plays the part of James Herriot, I think, in All Creatures Great and Small. It's a series on public television about that book series in England, and it's the same actor.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, Joe, and I wonder what you thought about this. I thought the beginning of the film was a bit confusing. At the beginning, you get the impression that you're watching a documentary about how this movie was made. Mm-hmm. I've seen it twice, and the first time I thought, whoa, what? Where's this going? And it kind of transitioned. It moves from what seems like a documentary. So they're putting the microphone in front of the face of the producer, in front of some of the actors, and they're commenting about how this movie was made. I think the movie was intended to come out before COVID-19, so that really kind of slowed things. But then it kind of transitions, and you see Max McLean kind of go on stage like he's going to give his stage talk, and then only slowly does it weave back to what becomes the narrative. And for me, I thought that was awkward. I've talked with a number of people who went to it, and they were a little bit confused as to how it kind of unfolded. Joe, I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, when I was sitting with my wife watching it, she gave me the elbow and said, is this how it's going to be the whole way? I said, I think this is just, showing how they made the movie. And then soon after I got the elbow, it transitioned, as you mentioned. So yeah, what I took out of that is, okay, this shows me what it takes to make a movie like this. And it's pretty cool. After the fact, you kind of get that. But yeah, you're right. It does throw you off, because I kept wondering, you know, is the whole thing going to be like this? And my wife did as well. I wanted to make another comment, if you don't mind.
Sure.
One of the things that I thought that was going to be difficult is, how do you cover Lewis's life? And it's the reluctant convert, but how do you cover everything to get to that point? And the answer is, I don't think you can, but what they did cover was great. I thought somehow they did it effectively. And it starts out with the actor McLean kind of telling you what the struggle was early on. And I thought it was very well laid out, better than Richard Dawkins could do it. You know, he lays out like the that we live in a purposeless universe and there's a struggle with the problem of evil. I thought, wow, that's pretty eloquently stated. You know, maybe Ken can address that on Straight Thinking. And, yeah. You know, he lays it out there and says that's why he's an atheist. But then he slowly comes around to becoming a theist, but not adopting the Christian faith. But they kind of did that stepwise, and I thought it was pretty well done.
I do too. They did cover a lot of ground, and I certainly thought as I watched the film, if you knew more about the life of Lewis, you would see all these pieces kind of coming together. But I agree with you. I think that they were able to do it effectively. And I think that what we also see is that sometimes Lewis's intellectual abilities, his articulate presentation of arguments is not as recognized as many people appreciate. And I think Max MacLean does a very good job of really, you know, taking you back to some of these types of reasoning. And, you know, if we could talk a little bit about Lewis, you know, he's born into a Christian family. His father, Albert, and his mother, Flora, are very dedicated Christians. His dad is a devout Christian. He's a literary guy. In fact, the story is that when Albert Lewis is presenting cases in court and defending his clients, he makes allusions to classical literature. And then, of course, Lewis's mother, Flora, she gets a degree in mathematics. She is very, very bright. The math gene, however, jumped over C.S. Lewis's head. Mm-hmm. He had no mathematical ability. I always tell Dave, that encourages me that such a bright man didn't know math well. But, you can imagine what the death of his mother meant to him. You know, he was kind of a mama's boy. And his brother, Warney, I think, was about 4 years older. And the loss of their mother hit Lewis really hard. And then the story is that Albert, who was a caring father, and he was a solicitor. In England, they differentiate a solicitor from a barrister. Solicitor is more on the lower courts, representing clients. The barrister is on the high courts, where you would have a court case. There is some connection with Lewis to industry. He provides well for his family, and yet he responds by sending his two boys away to England to go to school. And some people thought that he never really recovered adequately from the loss of his wife. And, you know, I don't want to be too critical of him. I mean, imagine losing your wife, losing your spouse. But I guess he thought maybe the best way of helping his children was trying to give them a good education. But I think Lewis and Warney thought that their father had really kind of abandoned them. And in fact, if you read Surprised by Joy, Lewis doesn't talk a lot about World War I, which, by the way, is depicted briefly in this new movie. Lewis doesn't talk much about the war, but he talks a lot about how unhappy he was at some of these schools. And this is kind of a foundation for Lewis losing his faith. He was baptized into the Church of Ireland, which would be equivalent to the Anglican Church. But he says by the time that he was a teenager and by the time that he begins to be tutored by Kirkpatrick, who was a Presbyterian who lost his faith, became an ardent atheist, and who was very skilled at logic and rhetoric, that Lewis at that point was an unbeliever. He had lost all of his Christian convictions. And yet there are contradictions that kind of come out of that. Lewis says in World War I, for example, he was angry at God for allowing this war. Well, how can you be angry with God if God doesn't exist? But yet Lewis later, when he looks back at this period, realizes that God's always there, that you are kind of having these discussions with God or about God, even if you have said that you're not an atheist. And I think that this is probably a little bit of the inside baseball that we get in Romans chapter 1, that even people who say that they are formally convinced that there's no God, that, you know, atheism is what they affirm, they hold a naturalist worldview, and yet maybe they're not fully aware of their conscious understandings. And this is, I think, a very important thing that, you know, fallen people, they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And, you know, it's also possible that belief in God doesn't start with reason. It starts with a deeper understanding. This is what John Calvin calls the sensus divinitatis, that God doesn't just give us an argument. He gives us an awareness of his divinity. And of course, the natural inclination is to suppress that. And apart from grace, someone will continue to suppress it. But it is interesting that, and notice, what is it that has disturbed Lewis? It's not necessarily a formal argument. It's the loss of his mother. It is this difficulty with his dad. And, you know, I might call that trust issues, that when people have a hard time trusting people, you know, if I can't trust my dad, if I've lost my mother and my dad has kind of, I feel abandoned by my dad, I may feel that God has done the same thing to me. And, you know, when I talk with non-Christians, there are times where I don't think that they're aware that there may be other things influencing their beliefs other than just arguments and reasons, that it runs deeper. As Pascal says, there are reasons of the heart, if you will. But it's also ironic that Lewis's recovery of belief in God, that it is both his atheism is influenced by Kirkpatrick, but it's also Kirkpatrick that teaches him to be vigorous in his reasoning and to analyze things. And in some ways, I think Kirkpatrick is the one who gets him back to thinking. And so he's converted first. He returns first to a belief in God, which we would call theism, and then a little later, he comes back to Christianity.
Ken, I have a question now that you mentioned his education with Kilpatrick. I like that part of the film. They show him studying in the home of, is it called a master? What do you call the, and his wife, and he's living there. And, you know, he's talking about all these works of literature. It's like, and I'm feeling ashamed that I haven't read all those. And then he kind of describes the day, how he's learning. And then he kind of gets to the evening and I'm thinking, okay, great time to turn on the TV. Nope, it's time for Latin and Greek. And I'm just, putting me to shame. The reason I bring that up is you mentioned the Lewis phenomenon. Could it be that because of his excellence in literature that he gets a hearing from certain people because he knows what he's talking about, and that kind of transfers over into other areas? What do you think about that?
I do. You know, this morning as I was thinking about the film, you know, Joe, at RTB, we talk a lot about evangelism. We talk about the Great Commission. All of us know that, you know, Hugh Ross is really a very strong evangelist, has worked in his church, and you know, Hugh feels very strongly that he wants to introduce people to Jesus Christ. Well, what's interesting is that Lewis's return to belief in God and then to Christianity, he is later influenced by people like Hugo Dyson and J.R. Tolkien and others there at Oxford. But I think one thing that a lot of people may fail to appreciate is it's books that have such an enduring influence on Lewis. And so he is reading these classical works, and he later says that it was books that kind of brought him back. And you know, you're right. He had you know, he was looking at them from a vantage point of literature. But, you know, I think in terms of our own apologetic ideas, I mean, sure, people, Christians have long, you know, give me a tract that I can give to somebody. I remember the four spiritual laws, for example. But the idea that intellectual people need something they can read, they can reflect on, something that allows them to, hey, let me think this through. And so definitely, Lewis had a first class education. He was a brilliant man. There are times where he says, I can remember everything I ever read. And there are stories by some of Lewis's own students who he tutored. No, he was never a full professor at Oxford. He was a tutor. He got passed over a couple times for positions. Tolkien, on the other hand, was a full professor. It was only when Lewis went to Cambridge that he became, the professor of medieval and Renaissance literature. But some of the students would say that, you know, he had his room there in Magdalen College, and the student would go into the library and Lewis would say, pick up any book you want. They pick out a book and read a sentence or two, and then Lewis would explain, well, that's this book, and here's what's happening in the context of this. I think Lewis really was a genius. It's interesting, however, that he had difficulty with memory. In Alistair McGrath's biography, again on C.S. Lewis Alive, McGrath argues that Lewis's conversion did not come in 1929, the Trinity term of 1929, that it was actually a year later. And Lewis was not very good at dates and, things of this nature. So, he of course, I think, opens us up to the idea of what about literary apologetics? Again, I know a lot of people who probably wouldn't pick up a scientific book or a philosophical book or a historical book, but they love literature. And Lewis and Tolkien, they kind of paint a story for them that, you know, that makes it very powerful. And of course, what people like Tolkien and Dyson were able to do for Lewis is to say, look, you know, there are all of these other religions and mythologies, and they're ideas that are pointing to truth. They don't have all the details, and they may be mere mythologies, but then Christianity is the true miracle, that it must have happened one time. And in the movie, Max McLean playing Lewis says, you know, he bumps into this secularist and he says, you know, it looks like this actually happened. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot about, I think, apologetics that we can learn from C.S. Lewis.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, Dave, you mentioned it early on about reading Lewis's other works. And Ken, you mentioned it at the very beginning that some people are not aware of his apologetic material, but they may have encountered him through the Chronicles of Narnia. I read some of the science fiction that you were talking about, Dave.
Right.
I think I read three or four of those books, and then The Great Divorce. And then, you know, it kind of expands your mind. It's very creative and imaginative. And then I was ready for Mere Christianity, I guess.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting that, you know, we come to these things in different ways, but I guess that's part of Lewis's phenomenon, Ken, that he can get you in different ways. And that's how I kind of came through, is through the science fiction.
I think it's probably a mistake on our part. You know, as apologists, we kind of think, well, I have my favorite series of arguments. You know, I have my favorite approach. You know, I want to look at the historical text, or I want to develop, you know, kind of scientific arguments that seem to buttress these philosophical arguments. But I think the reality, Joe and Dave, is that we are different people. Our minds are kind of wired a little different. We have different interests. And again, Lewis does that to a lot of people. I am not nearly as familiar with his, with his fictional writing as I am with his apologetic writing, but I have encountered lots of people who said, oh, you know, Lewis and Tolkien have just meant the world to me. And, you know, they paint a worldview picture, not as a conceptual system, but as a story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I've had to come back and, you know what, and say, I need to learn more about literature. This yeah. seems like a very powerful means of communicating Christianity. And,
Ken, I have go ahead, Dave.
Well, I was just going to say, I always like, we've made this comment before, that Lewis believes that the mind is the organ of reason and argument and thought, while the imagination is the organ of meaning. And I think that that's what happens when you tell a story. It grips you in a different way than an argument does. An argument so often is stirring up counter arguments, and you get into, you know, a fight back and forth, which is containing, you know, the best explanation and all that's important. But when you tell a story, it somehow grips you at a different level. It's the level of the intuition. And I think that it can be very persuasive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I, you know, I think, again, to somebody who has been dead for 58 years and still has that kind of influence. And again, I have I've seen people like Michael Ward and Alistair McGrath and other Lewis scholars, and you know, they give a lecture and there's just a packed house. People are interested in C.S. Lewis. You know, and by God's grace, he remains a real power, a real force, if you will. I want to say a couple things about kind of my takeaway from the movie, and then I'm hoping we'll have a little bit time. I'd like to read a few quotes from C.S. Lewis when he talks about apologetics. Now, I like the film. I have seen on social media that some people were a little put off by that beginning, that awkward transition. And I agree. I wouldn't have done it that way, but of course I'm not a movie maker, but I have seen people who were a little disappointed by it. What I want to say, however, is this, that whether you like the film or not, and I certainly did, I think there are two points that I want people to be thinking about. And the first one is this. In 2019, this biopic of Tolkien came out. Now, I liked that film. Some of my movie maker friends, they didn't particularly like the film. They didn't think it was necessarily a good movie. They liked Tolkien. They just didn't like the movie for various reasons. But what I said to them was this. I said, look, here you have a Christian intellectual, J.R.R. Tolkien, and here is a movie about his life on the big screen. And it becomes clear for people, you know, they may have read The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, and they may not know that he was a Christian. But this idea that there are Christian intellectuals out there. So my first takeaway is this. You need to go and watch this movie and support it, even if you don't particularly like all the details of the way the movie was made, maybe similar to the way the Tolkien biopic was made, but he's being depicted on the big stage. And here is the point. Not only is Lewis an atheist who comes back to theism, but then he's converted to Christianity. And, you know, I went to a luxury theater not too far from where I live and sat down, and I was looking at people who were around me, and I was thinking, wow, here is a movie that talks about an Oxford intellectual who became an atheist but returned to belief in God and then became a faithful follower of Jesus Christ. Think about the time in which we live. Isn't it a great thing that these movies are reminding us that two of the greatest writers of the 20th century were followers of Jesus Christ? Tolkien was a Roman Catholic. C.S. Lewis became an Anglican. So that's the first reason. Get out there and watch this movie, support it. And I think, you know, because it was only to have limited showing, the only reason it's still around is because there have been a lot of people coming out to watch it, because people like C.S. Lewis. And I would even say this, I think people are yearning for faith. Mm. People want, they want a story about faith. They want to hear about, you know, it's a good thing to have trust in God, and that your trust in God can be intellectually rigorous, if you will. Now, my second point, my second takeaway is essentially that, you know, this reminds us, I think, of this Lewis phenomenon. Lewis was wrong. He thought he was going to be forgotten 5 years after he's dead. If anything, he's picked up speed. This, I think, shows us that people are interested in good books. They're interested in good plays. They're interested in seeing Christianity presented on the big screen. And, you know, the Lewis phenomenon is a powerful one. And I want to say more about it in our next program, but unless you guys have a couple questions, I want to read a few quotes and kind of talk a little bit about some of what C.S. Lewis actually said about apologetics.
I had just a couple of comments. When we were in England and visiting his church in particular, there were a number of things that were said about Lewis that I really humanizes him. The first thing was that he was very reluctant to go to church because he just didn't feel connected. But he knew as a Christian that this was an important thing. And the church had several services, and he would go to the early service because he didn't have to engage with as many people. And in particular, he didn't like singing the hymns and so on. No. And I guess the singing took place in the later services and didn't occur in that early service. So I just thought, that's, you know, you think of Lewis as this great, you know, Christian that displays all these various kinds of outward glowing characteristics that you would expect to see in a Christian.
He's just like us.
He wasn't like that. He was a very private person. And I just thought that was very interesting.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, Dave, in McGrath's biography of Lewis, he says that Lewis suffered from shyness and social anxiety. And, you know, I just can't picture that.
No, I can't either.
You know, I am a shy person, and I have a certain amount of social anxiety, but I can't picture the great C.S. Lewis like that. But there are stories, even John Lennox, when we were at Oxford, Lennox came and gave a bit of a talk to us, to the RTV tour group. And Lennox mentioned that he was a young college student, and he got to hear Lewis. He felt very honored to actually walk into the lecture hall there at Oxford and to hear him. But he said that Lewis had a habit if he would come in right at the last minute, and he'd be fully clothed because there's a lot of rain and a lot of cold weather there in England. So he'd have a hat on, and he'd have a scarf and a heavy coat. And he, as he walked in the lecture door, he would he'd start taking off his hat and then his scarf, and he's lecturing all the way. So he'd take up all these clothing and then present more of his lecture. And then right before he ended his lecture, he'd start putting his clothes back on, continuing to talk. And then once he got his hat on, he was done and out the door. And you know, it's interesting. If I might say, I attend an Anglican church, and there's a lot of hymns in the Anglican tradition. And we have a vicar who is himself sang in the choir. And so he loves hymns. And And, you know, I'm always saying to my wife, I think there's maybe too many hymns, you know, and there are times I want to go out the door where I, partly because, you know, I've had my fill of hymns, but partly too, I have a certain social anxiety, and it was entertaining to hear that Lewis would leave during the last hymn. So he's more like you than you think.
Well, you know, related to this comment about him and his lecturing, you would think as a result that his lectures wouldn't be that popular. But in fact, they were very popular. There was standing room only in many of these lecture halls. He kind of reminds me of a scientist who had that kind of pull. That was Richard Feynman.
Yeah.
That Feynman just had this personality that people loved to listen to him talk. Now, he wasn't as socially awkward, I don't think, as apparently Lewis was, but he was extremely popular, Lewis was, and people just loved to hear his talks and lectures on the various subjects.
In fact, McGrath again reveals in his biography that Lewis's talks on the BBC were so popular during World War II that at the end of the war, Winston Churchill wanted to give Lewis a medal. Lewis declined, but there are people who said that Lewis had become an international celebrity in England. He had become popular. The book that really made him a celebrity in America was the Screwtape Letters. I think the evangelicals in America thought, this guy's one of ours. He believes in the supernatural. He believes that there is a demonic force. That allowed Lewis to become very popular. But he also not only gave these talks on the BBC, and you know, this is something that I have shared with people. I remember I had a friend who was very critical of Franklin Roosevelt. And I said, you know, there's something I think you have to appreciate about President Roosevelt. I said, with my mom and dad, and of course the criticism by conservative economic people is that Roosevelt's policies during the Depression actually extended the Depression. Now that may or may not be true depending on what school of economics you look at. But I told my friend, I said, you know, there's something else that stands out about Roosevelt. Roosevelt gave my mom and dad hope, you know, that we're gonna win this war, that God is on our side and we're going to win. I think Lewis's talks on the BBC really encouraged people. And one thing that came out of that is that Lewis was invited to go to the RAF bases, the Royal Air Force, who in many ways actually took the first step in defeating Nazi Germany. Churchill said, you know, never was so much owed to, you know, to so few. Talking about these men who went up in these airplanes and defended their island. Well, Lewis would go to the RAF bases. And of course he realized immediately that I can't give my standard Oxford talk here. You know, in England, and particularly in those days, you either went to a trade school or you went to college. There was no community colleges in those days. You were either a scholar or you would get some kind of training. And, you know, Lewis was talking to young men that were not well educated, and he was talking to men who probably weren't going to come back. They're probably going to be killed. I mean, the mortality rate for people on these British, planes was incredibly high, as there was in America. So Lewis said to himself, I have to talk plainly. I have to use non-scholarly language. And he later said, and this has had an influence on me, he said that he thought real intellectual ability is to understand substantive issues, but to be able to explain them accessibly. And that had an influence on me. I thought, well, you know, maybe I don't know the scholarly issues the way, you know, an Alvin Plantico would, but I can try to understand them and communicate them clearly. And Lewis talked about that, you know, as a real important thing. Well, let me read just a couple quotes as our time here is moving on. In my book, Classic Christian Thinkers, Chapter 9 is about C.S. Lewis. It is an introduction to his life. It talks about his key ideas. I introduce you to a couple of his books, Mere Christianity and the Screwtape Letters. I give you quotations by him, and there's a couple about apologetics I'd like to read and make a few comments on. He says concerning the role and the value of apologetics, he says to be ignorant and simple now, not to be able to meet the enemies on their own ground, would be to throw down our weapons and to betray our uneducated brethren who have under God no defense but us against the intellectual attacks of the heathen. Good philosophy must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy needs to be answered. You know, I know a number of philosophers who went into philosophy because of that quote. They engaged in a philosophical career because they wanted to serve the cause of Christ and offer a philosophical critique, because, you know, much of the criticisms of Christianity or belief in God find their source in philosophical ideas. And, you know, so Lewis talked about how important it is to have intellectual people. I think what's ironic, guys, is this: a lot of intellectuals don't feel comfortable in evangelical churches. I think a lot of times it's because there isn't a lot of intellectual content in our evangelical churches. And so they feel like the life of the mind is not a priority. But the irony is this: a lot of young people are leaving their churches, and they're leaving for intellectual reasons. Well, you got the intellectual people who could be part of that church, who can help these young people realize there are good reasons for faith. So I encourage evangelical pastors to think about intellectuals, scholars, as a field that they need to recruit. And you should be thinking in your sermons about argumentation and, you know, not just trying to reach the average common person, as important as I think that is, but also reaching people who come from scientific backgrounds and philosophical and historical backgrounds. Here's another quote. This passage, by the way, is written on the commemorating stone there in Westminster Abbey. It is the passage where Lewis says, quote, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." That's a very revealing passage from Lewis about the way he thinks. You know, when you look up at the sun, you can see the sun. But the amazing thing about this star that gives us heat and gives us light, everything else that we see is in light of that sun. It's not just that I see the sun, but it's in light of the sun that everything else is visible to me, and I'm able to live in that kind of context. I share that perspective on Christianity. I think if push came to shove and somebody said to me, "Well, what is the fundamental reason you believe in God and believe in the truth of Christianity?" I think I would say it's because Christianity has explanatory power and scope. It not only explains why there's a universe and why humans are the way they are, great and wretched, but it also explains the person of Christ, his remarkable moral teaching, but also his resurrection. Then there's one more quote. He says, "I have found that nothing is more dangerous to one's own faith than the work of an apologist. No doctrine of that faith seems to me so spectral, so unreal, as one that I have just successfully defended in a public debate. For a moment, you see, it has seemed to the rest on oneself. As a result, when you go away from the debate, it seems no stronger than the weak pillar." I can relate to that too. There are times we think everything rests on the cosmological argument or the teleological argument, or everything rests maybe on an argument for the resurrection. And yet there are times where faith is more than just the intellect. Faith has to run deeper than just merely the intellect. And, you know, it's not only important that we have good apologetics, but it's also important that we have apologists who are people of prayer, who are people of devotion and dedication. And I think Lewis teaches us a lot about the advantages of apologetics, but also its weaknesses. In fact, that's where I want to go on our next program. I want to raise the question, is it possible that sometimes apologists exaggerate the importance of apologetics? Now, that's a strange thing for an apologist like me, or an apologist of even greater right, like Lewis, to say, but I think Lewis would agree with that, that there are times you can exaggerate the role of apologetics. But we'll look at that next time. Joe, some sources, of course, I want to encourage people not only to read Lewis's books, for example, Mere Christianity would be a great place to start reading Lewis. We've mentioned already the Chronicles of Narnia. We talked about the Space Trilogy, the Ransom Trilogy, The Problem of Pain. A great book you might consider reading as well, the Screwtape Letters. So My chapter in my book, Classic Christianity, will introduce you to Lewis and give you lots of good book references.
All right. Very good. Thank you for that, Ken. We've been talking about the movie C.S. Lewis, The Most Reluctant Convert. I sure hope you have seen it or will see it and be part of the Lewis phenomenon, which continues to this day. Ken, a couple of people have been, some people have been writing in to show appreciation for your books. Let me read a few of the comments that have come in. Hello, Mr. Samples. I've enjoyed your content for a long time now. I came across your article on St. Augustine through RTB. I am currently at Southern Evangelical Seminary and am writing a paper on Augustine. I'm looking to get your book, Classic Christian Thinkers. This is Ryan Anders. Here's another brief comment. I love this show, Straight Thinking. It's my downtime go-to. That's from Sojourner on Twitter. Thank you for that. And one more comment here. Books like yours show the superiority of the Christian worldview, and I am encouraged after reading them. Shirley Eckel. Yeah. So those are encouraging comments. Nice to hear from you all. You have discovered how to reach Ken by his Twitter handle, which is @RTB_KSamples. So keep those comments coming. We appreciate them and want to give you a shout out here on the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any more podcasts. You can subscribe to the Reasons to Believe podcast, which is on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, and anywhere you listen to podcasts, and you'll get an episode delivered to you each week. For Ken Samples and Nave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.